to the latest episode of Open World Chat. I'm afraid today you're just having me, host John Odom, as Jim Dandino, to I'm sure his great regret, has had to be pulled away today on a family issue, which means he gets to miss the conversation that I'm about to have with comics legend Roy Thomas. Just his good luck. And we'll see what other good luck happens. See if my cat starts screaming behind me or something. But this is also the first time that we've dipped our toes into putting the V into AV here and having an actual video podcast. So if you haven't run screaming from seeing my face for the first time, dear
then you
listeners,
run screaming from seeing mine. So keep up on them.
That's right. So it's, you're missing out. So I, you know, you set something like this up, you start doing a podcast, and part of it, the hope is that you're going to end up getting to talk with some of your heroes. And this is the first time in the year of doing this where I can genuinely say I'm speaking to one of my heroes. I'm sure you get this all the time, and you may be rolling your eyes at the obligatory suck up here from the interviewer here, but
no, it's just, you know, terms like heroes are iconic and all, you know, it's just, it's, you know, cause I'm just writing these comic books. So it's, you know, not really used to thinking of, myself or other people in my field in those terms, I guess, you know.
God. That makes sense, you know, because you're there. See, all of us back here, it's right. you're up on the pedestal here. And I mean, the fact is that over the years, I can't think of another person in any art media who has brought me consistently more joy over so much good times and bad in my life. The debt I owe to you is just incalculable.
Did you pay for the books that you read, the comics? You pay for them? Well, then I thank you too, because it helped support me. So we just got something out of it.
And, you know, actually I was thinking about this. when I was a kid and I had reprints of the X-Men run you did with Neil Adams, and, you know, I would eat that up, and I realized I didn't realize until I really thought about it, that it really became for me the standard of what a superhero comic was. It's imprinted into my brain unconsciously, became what I judged and compared really every superhero comic I've read since to as my standard. And so you really you set my entire perspective on the medium.
So. Well, Neil's artwork certainly was, you know, so powerful. He was a new force in the field, the strongest thing to come along since Jack Kirby, really, you know, in that sense. And so, you know, I was along for the writing and I added a little something, but I could see where that could have a strong impression, especially with that artwork. Yeah.
Oh yeah. And your work has always synergized so well with the artists you're working with. It's
well, I always tried to adjust to the artist and not so much force the artist to adjust to my style. Maybe, you know, I think I probably did more of that than Stan. I think Stan was more of a strong force, you know, trying to keep everything consistent. I was a little more of a not exactly a chameleon, because I was still doing my Stan Lee kind of style, Marvel style writing. But I think I probably made more accommodation to an individual artist in some ways sometimes than maybe he cared to do. Maybe it's because I didn't have the strong, you know, presence and self-confidence and, you know, and aura that Stan did, even by the mid-60s or so. Mm-hmm. So I, you know, would try to adjust to the artists as much as possible and accommodate them. If they wanted to be more involved in the plot, you know, they could be, or less involved in the plot. Stan would sort of have his level that he wanted them to do, how much he wanted to do. And I would kind of roll with the punches. If Neil or Adams or somebody else wanted to do more, Gil Kane and I would plot stories together because he wanted to be involved. They didn't have to do it. They weren't going to be paid extra for it. You know, I was the writer, they were the artist. If they wanted to do more, you know, that was fine with me, but I wasn't going to push him into doing, you know, past a certain point. But Neil and even Gil wanted to get involved more, a few other people here and there. And, you know, and of course, after me, other people, you know, did the same thing. You know, Steve Englehart and Frank Brenner started Doctor Strange together. Frank wanted to be involved with the story, you know, more than he had to be. And out of that came, you know, a different product than from maybe if Steve had just written it and Frank just drawn it. But when you get the two people together, it becomes something different from what it would have been. It becomes a third product because then it's the two guys together in a more organic way, you know, and the comics, I think comics are kind of organic that way. You get a product at the end. It isn't Jack Kirby and it isn't Stan Lee. It's Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, you know, or however you want to call it. You know, it becomes almost like a third person.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've certainly seen combinations that didn't work together as well, where it didn't seem like the seamless fit. But yeah, organic.
No names.
The stuff you've done always seems very organic with the artist, and it's a very complete experience.
Well, some worked out better than others. Sometimes, you know, an artist wasn't too inspired, or I wasn't inspired by them, or they weren't inspired by me, and some of them didn't work out. Probably had, I don't know, had as many misses as hits, but I had some misses too, you know. Sometimes it didn't work out. So did Stan. So did everybody. Some teams work better, or they work better at different times. But every month, you know, you're starting to, you know, to see what you can do to hit a home run. You know, and sometimes you're lucky if you got a base on balls. You know,
who remembers the misses though, right? Who
yeah, well, I remember the misses. You know, yeah, I remember the misses.
Well. Listen, so we're having you on here today for an episode that I have informally, perhaps formally dubbed the Roy Thomas Halloween Special.
Why is that?
Why is that?
You're not going to hold this off till Halloween to show it.
No, it's Halloween in February.
Okay.
Well, I think when I dropped you an email a while back about doing this, you had said, oh, you're in Vermont. I'm in actually Montpelier, Vermont. I intended to do this broadcast from Rutland, Vermont, but couldn't guarantee a place where I wouldn't wouldn't be interrupted. But you made a comment about how, oh yes, your memories of Rutland and the Halloween parade.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, well, let's talk a little bit about that because I know a lot of folks who are listening, who are steeped in some of the legends of
those were the first and almost the only times I was ever in Vermont before or after, you know.
Well, that's the thing. Vermonters don't know about this. Yeah. Vermonters don't know about this. So
Probably lucky for them.
Oh no, we're here to educate them.
Yeah.
That's why we're here today. So
okay.
So Rutland, Vermont. Rutland. Why don't we just start off?
Is it cold up there? I always remember when I think of Rutland, Vermont, I think of my hands being cold when I was out somewhere outside by myself. Everybody else had wandered off, and I was doing some little something, adjusting something on a float sometime back in the 60s. And I think, and God, it was cold, even colder than New York.
It is, in fact, at this very moment, 25 degrees. Not bad. Not bad.
No.
Could be worse. But
yeah, it's a little warmer than that here, thank goodness.
What got you involved in a Halloween parade in Rutland, Vermont?
Well, the parade itself was going for some years before. They had just had a parade. I don't know when it started or how long it was going, but a guy that I got to know, I knew him as a comics fan. He had written one or two pieces that were published in fanzine. He was a very good writer, Tom Fagan. Mm-hmm. And he was a guy a little older than me, so forth. He had a family up there in Rutland. And He evidently, I don't remember all the details since I wasn't around at the time, but somewhere in the early 60s or so, or, you know, he went to the townspeople and he said that, you know, they needed a presence of some, you know, colorful characters and so forth. So he got himself made a Batman costume, and he appeared. I think he had a daughter. She might have played Batmite or something, or Robin or something too. And they would appear in the parade. That really wasn't much else than that. Maybe they had other things in the parade, you know, other people in little costumes, but this one comic thing, somehow it became kind of, kind of an annual tradition for just a couple of years or so, I guess. I wasn't there, so I don't remember all the details. I've read them, but I don't remember them too well. My involvement came in 1965 in July, which is only about a month into when I had moved to New York. And the guy I was staying with during that time, Dave Kaler, whom I had helped get a job writing for Charlton, Captain Atom, a character there. Before I moved to New York, he was the guy who was really putting this convention together. So I happened by sheer coincidence to be rooming with the guy who was putting on this, what was only the second real comic book convention. The first one had been a one-day affair in 1964. And this was the second one. And it was, you know, going to have a few hundred people or so. It was held in the Broadway Central, which at one time had been a first-class hotel. I've read about some of the people that came in there. At this stage on the Bowery, it was like it really run down. The stairs were creaky. Actually, the hotel, a few years later, it basically collapsed. You know, we're lucky it didn't collapse that day. But anyway, so we had this convention. Tom came down from Vermont. I was there. And, you know, my friend Jerry Bales, who had started Alter Ego, was there from Detroit and was running a panel with the writers. There were a number of professionals there. Unlike the first convention where it was Steve Ditko and Flo Steinberg and some intern at Marvel, this year there were like a dozen or two people, you know, Murphy Anderson, Jim Warren, Gil Kane, you know, a lot of people, a dozen or two. Otto, and the writers, Otto Binder, Bill Finger, co-creator of Batman, Green Lantern, so forth. So it was a nice thing. I met Tom, Amy Bofalo, we were talking, and he said, told me about this parade. Says, he was talking to me and Dave as roommates, and we had a costume. I had had my aunt back in Missouri when I knew I was moving and there was going to be this convention. I may as well go before I even knew I'd be staying with the guy running it. I had her make me a Plastic Man costume because I love Plastic Man. And Dave had a really wonderful Doctor Strange costume with a cape just right and everything else. It was great. And he said, you know, you guys ought to bring your costumes, come up to Rutland and be on the float with us. You know, we'll have a whole comic book of things. So instead of just Batman, we'll have Batman, Plastic Man, and Doctor Strange, you know. And so we decided, well, what the hell? We got nothing else doing. So come about, you know, a couple of months later, we take the train up to Vermont and we did this and it was fun and it was relaxed. And the next year, you know, I don't remember all the details, but the next year, you know, we got some other people to do. I remember I was real thrilled. Somebody recognized Plastic Man because remember, he hadn't been in the comic for about almost a decade by that point. But Dr. Strange, they were mostly saying, oh, look, a magician. You know, I mean, nobody knew who Dr. Strange was. He was one of the lesser Marvel characters. And except for Spider-Man, nobody would have known much of any of those characters. So we had a good time. The next year, one or two more people came. And finally, by the end of the 60s, I remember picking a big year like 69 or so, it had become really big. In between there, I decided to write a story set in the Rutland Parade that would have, you know, Marvel superheroes in Rutland, Vermont. I put myself and my then wife Jeannie in it and Tom into the thing and people standing around in costumes. I was in the Spider-Man costume. I had inherited Marvel and my wife was in the Invisible Girl, you know, standard FF costume and other people as this character, that character. So I did an issue of the Avengers that had the Rutland Parade in it. And that was a hit. People kind of came, and people liked. So the next year when other people went, two people wrote it. The next year I wrote one too, a second one, and then I gave it up. As a Defender story, again with Tom and GD and me in it. And Denny O'Neill, who was writing Batman for DC, he did this beautiful story with a, you know, old Nazis and echoes of the Holocaust and everything with Neil Adams doing this beautiful art job. A guy who's the villain was the Grim Reaper. He looked like a Grim Reaper, you know. And so we had two stories, you know, and it just kind of grew from there. And eventually, Steve Englehart, Len Wein, and Jerry Conway ended up doing kind of a cross-company thing where without letting their superiors know, these characters were appearing, you know, they did one thing in a Marvel comic and another thing in a DC comic. If you read them together in the right order, you actually had a three-part story. So it just kind of grew and for several years. And we had this wonderful house because somewhere along the line, not in 65, but right after that, Tom began to house-sit with his family, a big house. I think it's called the Claremont House now or something like that. It was a big mansion in this place. And they were staying there just to keep, you know, people from breaking in, you know, and so forth. And it was a great party house. So we had great parties, you know, and Tom did that for a number of years. Somewhere by the end of the 70s, it all, you know, kind of, you know, fell apart as people were developing other things and more people moved out of New York and so forth. But for, you know, a few years there from the middle and late 60s through about 1969 or 70, it was quite a scene.
Well, the mind kind of boggles, actually. Jim, my co-host who can't be here, Jim Dandineau, who writes for Den of Geek, he was like, you've got to ask him, just how much weed were they smoking during that time?
I don't know. I wasn't. Some of them may have been. You know, I'm sure increasingly by the late 60s, I'm sure there was a certain amount of it. The only thing I can remember from the 65 one, was just standing in here. This, as I said, it wasn't that one mansion. It was a fairly big house, wherever it was, and just seeing a whole mess of townspeople. I mean, there weren't any comics people. There was just B and Dave and you know, Tom as in Batman, and just, you know, and just watching things. And I remember Barry McGuire's record, The Eve of Destruction, kept playing over and over. Every third or fourth song was The Eve of Destruction. All the hate there is in Red China and all that, you know. That's my only memory of that party besides the parade itself. But you know, we helped make floats, and we had a, you know, people came. There were a lot of, I published some in Alter Ego. There were one year, maybe it was 69. I mean, you had people as Man Bat and, you know, and Thor and, you know, and Scarlet Witch. And I think I wore the Spider-Man costume once, a couple of times there. And, you know, they're just a lot, not all the comics people wore comics costumes. Some of them did, some of them didn't. They were just coming to have a good time. And I suspect a certain amount of, you know, controlled substances were uncontrolled.
Well, it's funny too. You know, you had your little sort of three-part story you put into the Avengers, but then this whole thing became a bit of a legend, right? I mean, references to the Rutland, to the parade start popping up for years to come from mm-hmm. other writers, folks who were never there.
A guy named Marty Grime had a Thunder Bunny comic at Charlotte or somewhere, and he had a Rutland story. It's two or three mm-hmm. other companies. My friend Don Glute was doing, I think, Dr. Spectre, a character he'd made up for Gold Key. And I think it was Dr. Spectre was the comic, and he had a couple of scenes in the he'd never been to the parade, but he did a Rutland parade story. You didn't have to go to Rutland to have a Rutland parade story.
You didn't have any sense that the locals had any idea that they were starting to be folded into a sort of comics world.
I don't remember,
legend.
But they must have been aware of it by the end, because, you know, some people would have told them. They probably had for one thing, Tom, I think, worked for the local newspaper. He probably, you know, so I'm sure they had articles. So I'm sure it was mentioned. It was, if you wanted to know about it, it was not a secret.
You know, there is, well, after the fact, some awareness that there was something special going on there, that, you know, a lot of folks were in the area.
Yeah, there wasn't much like it anywhere else. It just happened because of Tom, really. Tom mm-hmm. inviting us, then us telling other people. The next thing you know, the word spread, and you had a little mini phenomenon there.
You know, the fun you guys would have, and there is such a strong sense of fun that pervades all those comics that you guys are doing mm-hmm. in the 60s and the 70s. This is getting a little off from, you know, the Rutland stories and stuff, but, you know, it jumps into my head. Do you think comics these days have a hard time finding that fun sometimes?
Well, I don't know, because I don't pay much attention to the current comics. Mm-hmm. It's probably a little less community in a way, because remember at that time, everybody just about in the field was living in or around New York. So they all kind of knew each other. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I came from Missouri, but I moved to New York. So, you know, we'd all come from one place or another place to New York. Some of them, Marv Wolfman, Len Wein, Jerry Conway, they grew up in and around New York, but other people, you know, came to New York, but we got to know each other. I mean, you know, sure, there were people who didn't like each other and the whole bit, but mostly we got along, you know, at least on a reasonable basis. And some people were very good friends. And, you know, so there was a kind of an amiable group, you know, and so forth. And, you know, there were certain, you know, some of these artists that and writers, some of them were, and some other people who weren't really quite professionals, but they were friends of theirs, you know, and so forth. And so I think there was a good, I think it's kind of hard to recapture that now, but people nowadays could have something else. But it's a little harder to have that kind of thing, because at that time, almost everybody could get together on a bus. One time, I think in 69, I think we all hired a bus and drove up in a bus, you know, and 10 or 20 of us or something like that, you know. Yeah. My wife, Jeannie, and me, and we were all sitting around. I remember Marv Wolf and all these guys that came up on the bus together and so forth. But, you know, nowadays it'd be, you know, that could be done, but it's a little less likely. Nowadays, of course, the last couple of years, people don't even go into an office at all, you know,
right,
at Marv or anywhere. And DC's moved to the West Coast. This is a time, too, when Marvel and DC were both just, you know, a 10, 15-minute walk from each other. Mm-hmm. And everything. Now you'd have to fly across the coast for Marvel to talk to DC. You know, Marvel's based in New York to the extent it's based anywhere, and, you know, for the comics. And DC is now, you know, a little tiny corner of Warner out in L.A., you know, and so forth. So it would be a lot harder to even get the people from the same companies together. But, you know, if people want to get together, they find some. There'd be some other equivalent maybe of Rutland. I wouldn't know what it would. I'm too old for that kind of thing now.
Yeah.
Not necessarily dignified, but old.
Great big Zoom parties just somehow don't have the same ring to it.
Wouldn't be the same. No, the Zoom party. No, no. they might have their virtues, but it wouldn't be the same kind of virtue. It
wouldn't be the same kind of thing at all. No way. So you referred to earlier the Spider-Man costume.
Yeah.
So this is a Spider-Man costume that has developed its own life over the years.
Why don't you... Like the symbiote, right? You know, like...
Yes. Never occurred to me there.
Yeah, so, me either until you said that. Yeah.
Tell me the story of the costume here.
Well, there's a few details I'm not sure of, but sometime in the first few months after I came, which means later 65, early 66, somewhere in there, Saul Brodsky, the production manager, who was Stan Lee's like right-hand man, I mean, and if he said something, you knew it was kind of coming from Stan. I mean, you know, he never would have told me a secret Stan didn't, you know, want me to know or anything like that. So I knew it was anything he told me was always semi-official and with Stan's approval. And he took me aside and he told me, even though I'm a little foggy on one or two things I haven't traced back, he said, we have four costumes here of characters. It's a Spider-Man, a Fantastic Four, which could be Invisible Girl or Human Torch, Mr. Fantastic, and a Wasp costume and a Medusa, you know, who is a newer character. Wasp wasn't that old herself. We have these four costumes. The story Saul told me, which may have not been entirely accurate, but there's some accuracy in it, I'm sure, was that these costumes had been sewn for Marvel by a professional seamstress. I don't know how long ago, could have been fairly recently. But to be in what I understood was like the Macy's parade. Well, that was about, what, that's at Thanksgiving? So maybe it was the Thanksgiving 65, but I was working for Marvel Thanksgiving 65. I don't remember hearing anything about Marvel characters going to appear in a costume thing. I don't think it was the latest 66, but I don't remember that either. So I'm not quite sure. But anyway, besides they didn't. What they said is they hired four actors. I don't know what, some men, whatever, who is what. But they hired four actors to play the parts, just walk in the parade and get a little publicity for Marvel. And that's all I heard about it. Except, according to Saul, they made the mistake of paying them in advance. You don't pay actors or singers or anything like that in advance. But what happened is the guys never showed up, But they didn't take the costumes. Somehow the costumes got left. But, Marvel was kind of left in the lurch. They had these costumes and they were thinking about just throwing them away because they weren't going to try it again. And they said, and Saul said, again, as I said, I knew he spoke for Stan. He wasn't doing this just on his own. He says, would you like to have them or we'll just throw them away? I said, I'll take a costume. And, why not? Just stick it in the closet somewhere. As I said, I ended up wearing the Spider-Man, I think, to Rutland once or twice and one or two other little things, one New York convention at least. Appeared in a Marvel comic later in it, not Brand X. I was actually
Carnegie
in
Hall.
It.
Carnegie Hall.
Oh, yeah. And then, of course, I ran up and down the halls of Carnegie Hall in January of 1972 wearing it. So I played Spider-Man in Carnegie Hall when I wasn't singing on stage and had a great time at that. But the costume itself, it was just, it was okay. It was fairly good, but I mean, it was not really made to stand a lot of wear because it was going to be worn one time. But it was not a bad costume. It was red and the kind of purple. He hadn't evolved into more of a blue yet. So I had that for years. Both my wives have worn it to costume parties with me. At various times. I haven't worn. It's been many years. It's been 30, 40 years since it was last, worn by anybody. But so finally, my wife, Dan, and I decided to, we have my manager, John Cimino, whom here, who's here. We decided we would just, get together and sell the thing and so forth, so we kind of, found somebody that wanted to pay a decent amount of money and made a nice little profit off this thing that I had for 40, 50 years and, that had just been sitting around in a closet. The Invisible Girl costume is still sitting around a closet. The guy is interested in that one too, but he hasn't quite, decided to buy it that one yet. Wouldn't bring quite the money that the Spider-Man one did. They were all in a closet along with the original Star Wars shirt that I had from the Lucas organization that I wore to the 1975 San Diego convention a year before Star Wars came out. Mm. So all that stuff just got stuck into the bottom of a drawer somewhere. You know, the Spider-Man costume is now gone, but I'm hoping it had a happy home. John should send you a picture of
the
costume, you know,
and something you should
when
know
we were in New York with that thing on a mannequin behind us.
And something that you should know, John, that somebody came, remember with Schneider that came out, they were claiming that they had that costume.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Go ahead. Do you remember that story, Roy?
It was a dealer. They, you know, I don't accuse them of anything, but the dealer and the promoter who put on the Carnegie Hall show, whom I didn't know that well, but I mean, you know, we had a lot of stuff going on at that time for a little while. And somehow he had put out an ad saying that he had some other costume. You could tell if you looked at a photograph, it was not that costume. And he said, this is the costume worn on stage at Carnegie Hall and the show and this and that. And I don't know if I had to carry it through, but I had to kind of threaten him with legal action, really, because it was not. Nobody except me, you know, at least unless they've done it in the last few months, has ever worn that costume. And I didn't wear that costume. It was a whole different thing. I'm not saying the guy was lying. Maybe he really thought it was that costume. But anyway, it got a little bit bitter because, you know, if somebody has a costume that isn't the authentic one, then when you try to do something with the authentic one, you know, it looks like a copy. So there's always, no matter what is nice that happens, there's always unpleasantness associated with it, seems as it has to be.
And then when we were trying to sell it, when I brought it back to the public in 2000, what was that convention that we did at
2017,
we brought it to New York.
Yeah.
I had the New York Post do a big article on it. And what happened was
the guys from the
Hakes Auction,
one of the auction places.
Yeah, one of the auction places estimated it at only $2,000 to $3,000. We were so pissed because he thought it was like one of the electric company
from the early 70s.
But anyways, we got the.
So he did us some harm, but we. I'm sure you'll be glad to know we made a nice hefty profit. Yeah. That's your concern, of course.
Excellent. You know? Absolutely. Although I do hope it eventually finds its way to the Smithsonian.
But, yeah, I don't know what the guy intends to do with it, but it's, you know, it's up to, as a matter of fact, my understanding from John is that the guy who bought it from us, though he intended to keep it, has actually sold it.
Yeah, I don't know, but he contacted me again, and because we have the Fantastic Four one.
Yeah, because he was interested
He's interested in that one, so... So, you know, like I said, it's a hefty price and all that stuff, but I don't know if he sold it. I heard that he sold it, but when he called me, I totally forgot to ask him about that. Mm. So I'm going to find out because he's a big costume collector from Hollywood and all that stuff.
What I hate is the fact that after the show at Carnegie Hall in early 72, I appeared, I wasn't wearing the costume, but I appeared singing a couple of songs, rock songs on there, you know. It was my way of taking part. Yeah, taking part in the show. I thought, well, you know, if we're going to have a Carnegie Hall show, I may as well be in it and be, you know, maybe as well sing at Carnegie Hall. Why not? I'm not doing anything else that weekend, you know.
Okay, if you got recordings, things go so in the Smithsonian too.
Well, I was doing a lot of free work. I was going to run around in the Spider-Man costume part of the time. I wrote a bunch of pieces. I was so thrilled that, like, my guy, you know, met, knew, and really admired work, Tom Wolfe, the late novelist, journalist, read, you know, was one of three or four people reading things I had written. You know, he's on the stage reading something I wrote about Captain America while wearing his trademark white suit and everything. So I decided, well, you know, maybe I should do something else. So I said, hey, listen, a couple of us, you know, have done something with, you know, rock music from time to time. I had been singer in a band. My best friend, Gary Friedrich, who co-created Ghost Rider, was the drummer who had actually started that band back in Missouri. Barry Smith, the Conan artist from England, he played a guitar. I don't know if it was lead or rhythm. I forget which. And Herb Trimpe, the Hulk artist. Mm-hmm. You know, we were all the same general age. Barry was, you know, somewhat younger and so forth. But so I said, you know, let's have the four of us get up and do it. Well, Gary couldn't make it. There was a snowstorm and Gary got there too late to actually play with us. So somebody else had to do the drumming, but unfortunately, but you know, it's basically like it's a little Marvel rock group. it was all screwed up. I mean, the sound equipment wasn't working. The guy, we never got a chance to practice on the stage. The first time we were on singing at Carnegie Hall, we were at Carnegie Hall. We never got a chance to practice except in a studio down in Soho. And then the sound equipment was right. We were supposed to have banter between us before, and that didn't work because the mics weren't working. But the music was away. But the funny thing about the costume, the connection with the costume is that, not with Spider-Man, I kept that for myself for later, but the other three that could all be worn by women, Wasp, Medusa, and what could be Invisible Girl. My first wife wore the Invisible Girl costume, and there was a model friend of ours. She had a little modeling agency in Jersey, and she got one of her models, and they took the other two costumes and danced. Unfortunately, they never gave the costumes back. I didn't really pursue it, you know, at the time. And so those two costumes, I don't even know if they still exist, but if they ever pop up, you know, technically they're still mine, folks. I never gave them away. I just loaned them out. They're stolen. So give them back to me so I can sell them and make money.
Yeah, you can sell them the NFTs.
I do hope that whatever, I hope they still exist, but, you know, they were kind of flimsy things. If they weren't taken care of or stored away and forgotten, you know, they would very quickly disintegrate.
My mom's a pretty good seamstress, and so she kind of, on the Spider-Man costume, she kind of nicked up the little points.
Because I remember when you had it on the mannequin there at the convention, you could see the neck part. It wouldn't quite fit over there. And one of the boots had gotten loose, so we had to substitute something else for that. But the guy knew that when he bought it.
But even the spider web, my mom's like...
It had spider web under the arms, yeah, like the original, like the old Spider-Man.
But my mom did it impeccably. She did, and I got it steam pressed and everything. Yeah. So it was...
It looks good. Picture you and me in that. And Jeannie, who had worn the other costume, and the costume in the back on a mannequin. It was really funny.
And when that's something interesting that when we were at that convention in 2000, when we were at that convention in 2017, where we displayed it first, Jeannie, his ex-wife, actually shows up there. First, she walks right in front of the table, and I'm like, excuse me, ma'am. And then she's like, she points at Roy, and she goes, I'm Jean Thomas. And I was like, oh, my God. And she was wearing a Spider-Man shirt. Remember that? Yeah. So it was kind of funny. And the reason why she came was because she saw that ad in the New York Post.
The article, the big double spread.
On the Post, yeah. Yeah. And so the Spider-Man costume kind of brought a little reunion back.
Yeah, first time I'd seen her about a decade or so.
So it was really cool.
Yeah. So anyway, it was, you know, it's kind of weird, but that costume got up to Vermont a time or two and so forth too. So it's part of that story. And I was, both times I appeared in the, at least one time I appeared in the comic, it was supposed to be me wearing the Spider-Man costume, you know, and I had my, and everything, and Jeannie wearing the Invisible Girl costume. So it's that costume, drawn once and photographed once, was in a couple of Marvel comics in the 60s.
Yeah, and there's a few more with you in the costume, like in some of those other
ones. Oh, yeah, in the ones that the crossover between DC and Marvel, there's Spider-Man is supposed to be me, although, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, and then that one with Green Lantern fighting that guy in the Spider-Man costume, that could be you.
Could be.
Yeah,
anyway, that's my moment of fame there.
Oh, please tell me that there's a recording somewhere existing of you guys playing your music and doing.
No, guy who did this, he would, there's a little bit of footage of, like, you know, Stan talking and the giant guy that he had on in connection with the Hulk, but there wasn't much. And the thing is, he wouldn't allow photographs to be taken.
Oh, you know, that was my next question.
And he wouldn't allow, and he didn't take any himself. No, this guy, he was kind of a half an entrepreneur. He had this idea. He couldn't make money with the Carnegie Hall show. He didn't charge enough for the tickets because he wanted to, you know, have a nice full crowd. And we had a sold out crowd, at least that one night, for an evening at Carnegie Hall. An evening with Stan Lee and Marvel Comics at Carnegie Hall. Stan Lee got top billing above Marvel Comics. But unfortunately, they didn't photograph us, even without sound. It would maybe be better without sound. There's nothing existing that shows us together at any point. We didn't have anything taken at the, even when we were practicing, alas. I wish we did.
My blog, right? The one with the Roy Thomas Spider-Man costume?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay. If you notice, there was some shots, like pictures, like of outside shots and all that stuff. You know, maybe some people took, but nothing was ever like inside. Nah. So it was unfortunate.
So I'm afraid that I would love to have it. I would love to have the recording of it, whatever it sounds like, even though the equipment was so bad. Who knows how it sounded like. You know, some people liked it. A couple of people wrote in there, you know, Roy Thomas got up and started singing like it was like his business, but it wasn't his business, you know. And I didn't worry about that because, you know, I actually had made, you know, I not a living, it was a weekend thing, but I had actually, you know, been a singer in a rock band with Gary for 3 years, and nobody paid me to play an instrument because I didn't play an instrument. Certainly nobody was paying me for my good looks, so I must have been able to sing well enough to be the only singer in a rock and roll band of four people for 3 years. So I wasn't worried what a couple of guys wrote in a fanzine, you know.
What was the name of the band? What was the name of your band?
Oh, we had two names. The original name, which was the best, was Gaberlunzies, which is an old archaic word several hundred years ago. It meant a wandering beggar. When Gary and I and a few other people used to ride around in my old 52 Chevy back in Jackson, Missouri in the early 60s, we had that name just for ourselves as a name of a kind of a group. It was kind of an informal thing, Gaberlunzies. And somebody else, not Gary or me, had come up with that word. But the trouble, we had that for 6 months or a year, but it turned out, I know you'd be shocked to hear this, but nobody could spell or even remember what the word Gaberlunzies. So it was causing us problems, you know, because you can't hire a band if you can't remember their name.
Right. You just told me the name and spelled it, and I can't.
So Gary changed it to the Galaxies, which made me sick, you know, because the Galaxies is such a generic, you know, kind of name. But coming out of Gaberlunzies, I guess he wanted to keep the GA. So what's the difference? But I like the Gaberlunzies better. To me, they're always the Gaberlunzies, never the Galaxies.
I'm going to practice that word.
We had four members, Gary and me and another guy and Rocky, who was our resident sort of juvenile delinquent guitar player. Great guy.
And you said you were writing the music for it? Is that
No, we just did covers.
We did
covers of, you know, Elvis and Bobby Darin and whatever else was coming out. The Beatles kind of broke us up because when the Beatles came out by the end of the 63 and beginning of 64 around there, you know, we didn't really do any group things and maybe we'd have broken up anyway, but somehow or other, we just kind of, I think the Beatles kind of, I don't know, made us feel like, you know, they wanted a whole different sound that we didn't really have anymore. You know, although I loved the Beatles, but that wasn't us really.
Ah, damn those Beatles. They wrecked everything.
The yeah.
Oh God, I would love to hear. No chance of, you ever getting back together with the band at this point?
No, the closest thing we ever came is that in 1966 to 67, 66, Gary and I wrote and recorded a song that we made up while walking around Washington Square Park when we lived in Greenwich Village for 6 months at the end of 65, beginning of 66. It was called, Here comes this, watch out, here comes the Spider-Man. No relation to the one that was on TV, because this is before the TV thing. It has no lyrics in common except that title. We started with the line that one of us, maybe Gary, came up with and said, which was, nobody loves you when you crawl along the wall. And the other one was, when you look like a tarantula, folks don't think you're sincere. And from there on, it was Gary would always think of it as being like a coaster song. But what it really was, and he'd kind of forgotten this, it was really very much like Alley Oop. Remember the song Alley Oop, the Hollywood Argyles, you know? It had that same beat and rhythm kind of, you know, just bouncing along. It was slow.
I have it right here if you want to hear it.
You want to hear it?
I see. I was just about to say you used the R word. You said recorded.
Yeah.
So I'm like, yeah. Oh, somebody I've got to hear this.
When we, you know, so fix it up a little bit, so I don't think it hurt.
Look out! Here comes Spider-Man!
That's me and Gary and a few other people.
Oh,
it went off. Anyway, nobody loved you when you crawl. You could tell the coasters feel too. That, you know, the bass voice coming in at the end. Anyway, that's all we can do without getting in more trouble. You know?
that's right. Gary Friedrich in the back doing that.
Gary was the drummer and was doing backup. And his girlfriend and another friend were like singing, you know, the girls' parts and helped out. It was produced by my friend, later roommate, Len Brown, was a young executive at Topps Chewing Gum, who hired Gary and me to do a lot of Batman cards and different things over there over the years, Gary especially. And he was a big comics fan who eventually helped Topps start their line in the 90s, you know, and so forth. So he was kind of the producer of the thing. And so we had a great time with it. We were going to try to market it. We even got somehow, we got Stan's informal permission, not that he had the power to give it because he was only the editor, to maybe try to market what Martin Goodman would have done if we had sold it, either as the singers or, you know, if somebody took it and, you know, had somebody else record it, we'd have, you know, we'd have been the writers of it anyway. But the only interview we ever got was with Roulette Records. You remember Roulette Records?
Oh,
Roulette was bells. It was a fading thing by then. It was kind of big back in the 50s. A number of different things. One of the big things they had was the singer Jimmy Rogers, who had Honeycomb and stuff like that. You know, but they had several other things. He was a fairly big outfit. Evidently, one of the crookedest of the outfits. I was told that one of the owners actually died of a heart attack while on his way to jail or prison, you know, later on. And they were so famous for not paying that. And people wrote this in books later, you know, people who'd worked for them, for not paying royalties. And Jimmy Rogers himself was knocked down and got some kind of head injury from which he never totally recovered his memory and so forth in L.A., knocked down by a couple of cops supposedly for whatever disorderly conduct, but as far as everybody knows or suspects, you know, it was really just a hit job from the because he was pushing for royalties from the company. So we're probably lucky we didn't get it. We could have got beat up in L.A. too, you know. And this guy said, "Oh, that kind of music's never coming back." So you know, he wouldn't even listen to it, and that was the end of that. We put it on the shelf and later dug it out. And the last time it was played, I guess, was a couple of years ago. They sort of had a
Roy Thomas Day,
you know. Festival at my hometown and an
art, the key to the city,
an art festival, and so they played that in the background while we were there. It's, you know, it's not like a great recording, and it was, you know, a little primitive and everything, but you know, we had a lot of fun doing it. That's the only thing that remains of my so-called singing career besides the one photograph of me in like and still in high school in 1958 singing, you know, the day after I did an Elvis imitation at an assembly. And that's it. Everything. Unfortunately, Gary with his drums and the guy who co-wrote the song and was the leader of the band later and everything, Gary never got in the photograph. He was like off panel, you know, off the photograph. So there's not a single photograph of Gary with a drum anywhere, not even in the high school yearbook. You know, there's no scene that there's nothing that proves that Gary Friedrich and a drum were ever in the same room.
Well,
but anyway, we had a lot of fun for 2 or 3 years with that. We didn't make much money, and if we did, we'd buy a few beers and sit around a riverbank, you know, drinking or something, you know, you know, swapping stories. We'd, you know, make $10-$20 a night was a good night, even though that was, you know, a lot more money in 1963 than it is now. But we had a lot of fun with it. It's really one of the happiest experiences of my life. I probably like that even better than being a comic book writer in certain
really?
Ways. Certainly, it at the very least rivals it. Yeah.
Well,
I was never going to be Elvis or Bobby Darin or any of that stuff, but I really enjoyed it.
I spent some time playing in a band. Actually, just had a 30-year reunion. and you know, you don't. There is no place you get more stories than playing in a working band. Mm-hmm. I mean,
well, you know, John was a hardcore rocker too back in the turn of the 21st century and everything called Grimlock. Yeah, he was. That was wild. He's the loudest singer I have ever heard. You know, with or without with or without sound equipment.
But we had some pretty. We have albums in stores. Like yeah. We got pretty successful.
Yeah.
And stuff.
No kidding.
Yeah,
yeah.
We played with.
Oh, yeah.
All the big bands and all, like, yeah, now they're a lot big. Like, yeah.
He had an actual career, you know, for a few years.
I did it for 10 years,
yeah.
But, yeah, it was crazy.
But all of us wanted to, back in when I was growing up, 58, you know, nobody I knew even owned a guitar, you know. I mean, our little, that first group when we sang the assembly, all it was a piano and drums and me, you know, and then later we got a couple little bigger and we had a couple years later and had the band and everything, but it was four people and only three instruments, you know. So it was not much of a band, but we had fun. We were never discovered by anybody except you know, the cops for double parking probably.
I just
because you,
I just sent you the picture of Roy singing to your text.
Yeah, that's like, that's like January, February of 58. I was a senior in high school. I had my sort of painted on Elvis birthday. I was wearing his turtleneck sweater because I was trying to look like Elvis in Jailhouse Rock, where he sings the song Baby I Don't Care by a swimming pool. But that's the turtleneck sweater is where the resemblance pretty much ends. I don't even know what I was singing.
I haven't seen the picture yet, but I already know it's going to be the picture of the, you know, of this episode. I got it right there.
And poor Gary's in the back playing drums, but we know one's
yeah. Yeah, the pianist, you can see the pianist who just passed away a few months ago. I hadn't seen him though in years, but you can't see the piano. It's off. You know, and I don't recognize any of the people in the audience. They were all I knew them all then, but I don't know, you know, don't recognize him. I don't know who took the picture either. Was it my girlfriend? Was it somebody else? I don't know. My mother had it, but she wasn't there, so I don't know who took the picture. I wish I did. Anyway, but that's just, you know, something I think about. You know, being in it, and John, you get nostalgic for that kind of stuff because it was no matter what you were doing, it was a little more innocent time, and you had this youthful enthusiasm, and these three or four guys would blend together in this group with, you know, liking each other and hating each other and trying to make a buck, and then, you know, the car breaking down and everything else, you know.
Yeah. Oh, universal stories.
Do that now are people like, what's that band, the Remainders or something that Dave Barry and Stephen King and these guys do or something. They can afford to do it because they don't need the money, you know.
Well, there you go. Keep an eye on them in case they, you know, need another.
Yeah,
singer.
Right. You know. Yeah. If you need a comic book writer, I'll fill in.
And the music, the comic book writer, you've lived the dream. This is the life I wanted to have. What happened?
I don't know. You know, writers lead, you know, pretty dull lives, really, you know, because you just sit, you know, you're sitting at a typewriter. I think the best thing about my job was the fact that I got an office job at Marvel, that I wasn't hired to sit at home and write stories. I was hired to sit in the office and write stories. And when I discovered I couldn't do that, they sort of switched me over to editing, and I wrote the stories at home. But I had a 5 day a week, or later down to just 3, and I wrote at home the other days. But it was nice because that way I got to know people. You know, I got to know all the artists. I was there, you know, when I don't remember the exact day, but sometimes I remember when I remember the day I met Bill Everett, the creator of Submariner. I remember the day I met John Romita because they both came in, you know, from and everything. I don't remember the day I met Steve Ditko or Kirby, but I know about when it was, and I remember, you know, certain things about it. And of course, Stan Lee even before that. And over at DC, you know, there was Julius Schwartz, the editor. I liked so much of Flash, Green Lantern, Justice League. And, you know, my boss, Mort Weisinger, the horrible editor of Superman and people like that. My favorite comic book artist, one of the great Joe Kubert, you know, people like that. I mean, you know, it was nice. They're all, you know, almost all gone now. In fact, all the people that I knew back at that time pretty much are gone. Most of them were older than me, one or two younger, you know, like even Gary's gone for a couple of years, and he's two or three years younger than me. But matter of fact, we used to have a Missouri Mafia of people me and three people I brought in the field. They call it the Missouri Mafia. We didn't hang around together. Gary and I were friends. But Gary Friedrich, who co-created Ghost Rider, Steve Gerber, who co-created Howard the Duck, sure. And Denny O'Neill, who was mostly known, well, for the Green Lantern, Green Arrow stuff with Neil Adams, and later for as a writer and editor of Batman very successfully. And, you know, two of them were younger, one a little older. But, you know, now the Missouri Mafia is basically me at the age of 81, you know. But I'm glad I had that office job so I could get to meet all these people and not just be sitting at home, you know, typing away and, you know, mailing my stuff in or coming into an office for 5 minutes once a week like the other guys did.
That was like Joe Sinnott.
Yeah, Joe Sinnott, who was out on Long Island because you had to sort of live in the New York area. But for like 8 years, which includes the first several years I was there, he never came in the office. Nobody had ever seen him for 8 years. You know, he just mailed his stuff in wonderfully. Other people, you know, like Jack Kirby would come by about every Friday. And he and Stan sometime, you know, would go out to lunch, sometimes with us, usually without us. Jack would sometimes join us if Stan was doing something else. But, you know, so I'd be sitting there with, you know, at a table with Saul Brodsky, who had been a comic artist for years, and Frank Jacoya, the inker, and John Romita, Bill Everett, the colorist Stan Goldberg, who also became a great Archie artist, and a couple of people like that, whoever else was passing through, Kirby once in a while. and hearing him tell stories about, you know, the comics code, you know, when it first came in, taking all the, he's doing a Western, and people kept, says people kept taking the code kept taking the tomahawks out of the Indians' hands and leaving me with a bunch of smiling Indians. He says, you know, things like that. And, you know, it was just nice, you know, hearing this shop talk kind of stories from people that, and they were talking, and what they're talking about is the work they did, because they were all 10, 20 years older than me. What I'm talking about, what I'm hearing is stories from people about stuff I read. Because like Kirby was talking about the comic Bullseye with that tomahawk story. Well, I was a, you know, something like a 10, 12-year-old reader of Bullseye, this Western character, you know. And a couple of years later, I'd swipe the idea of the brand on his chest for the Iron Fist character, you know. So these were, you know, the word idol wasn't exactly what I would have used, but it amounted to the same thing, you know, that these were all people that some of them were favorites, and at the very least they were people whose work I respected. Most of them seemed like decent enough guys. They got along pretty well. I got along well with them. You know, some liked me or I liked them better than others, but it was not bad. It was at least as good as most workplace situations.
At least, I'm sure.
Beat the hell out of my teaching career, which I hated.
A teacher too.
Oh, right, for 3 years before. Yeah. Four years.
Well, listen, I've taken about as much time as I was allotted, and I don't want to be greedy with your time here. I really appreciate this. This has been so much fun. I'll ask you before I let you go, though, I'll ask you a sort of writer philosophical question here, because I'm hoping I have my own thoughts on this.
But okay.
This is a conversation I go back and forth with my kid about. So I'm not gonna tell you what I would say, but I'm hoping you will agree with me so that I can hold.
I agree with you.
All right. So, what do you, if you were asked to describe the difference between a hero and a superhero, what would you say?
Well, to me, a superhero doesn't have to have any particular personality or whatever, but to me, a superhero is just the guy with some kind of special power or ability. I admit, you know, I hardly think of somebody like Batman as a superhero, because, you know, he's got a lot of gimmicks and weapons, but anybody could have those. I mean, he trained himself, he's good shape, but, you know, to me, a superhero is something with something that's above and beyond ordinary human beings. It could be a physical power or a mental power. The most impressive things are really the heroes, the people that do it without having special powers. You know, I mean, you know, this is the cliche since could go back anywhere, and they started doing it a lot from the 9/11 time on. But I mean, you know, the real heroes, the people that have to do this without any special powers, the soldiers, the firemen, you know, policemen, you know, just common everyday citizens sometimes who get involved and help out something. Those are a lot braver. And, you know, some of them almost amount to superheroes. I mean, they're at least as admirable. All that you try to do is you take that, you make the person into a superhero by just giving them ability to do one thing or maybe a bunch of things a little bit better than anybody else. And it's funny because the superhero and the superhero comic and even the superhero movie, it's really, no matter what you do to it, how you dress it up, even in the movies, and I love them, it's really a sophomoric, if not juvenile, concept. You know what I mean? It was created for 5, 6, 10-year-old kids. Whoever reads it now, and it's certainly a lot older audience now, and they're written and drawn differently, but it was made up for young kids. They never expected anybody who was 10 or 12 years old to read them. They felt that, you know, every few years the audience totally turned over because kids hit either 10 years old or they hit puberty or something, you know, and they stopped reading comics and never came back. And all that happened in the last 50 years is that they either came back or, in many cases, myself included, they never left. And I mean, it didn't really answer your question, but what the hell?
Oh, sure you did. Sure you did. And for me, the appeal has always been how superheroes break the rules. You know, a hero can be stuck in an alley. There's only, you know, against the bad guys. It's only so much they can do in real life. There's only so much you can do if they've got the numbers and the fists and the knives. But a superhero can break the rules.
They're always the gradations. I mean, Batman is not back when the early days of fandom, they don't do this anymore, but I remember it was a big thing with some of the fans, especially some of the ones who came from science fiction fandom, and so they were a little more sophisticated about these things, I suppose, back in the early 60s. And they would make a real difference between the superhero and the costumed hero. The costumed hero being someone like Batman, who doesn't supposedly have any real superpowers, even though the things he does, he might as well, you know, but it's, mm-hmm. it's just gimmicks as opposed to say, Superman. The difference between, you know, Mr. Scarlet or somebody, but of course there are all the gradations. What is Captain America? He seems like just a normal super athlete, but it's because he has that super soldier formula. So he's a superhero, but how is he that much different from Batman? You know, who's going to win in a fight between him and Batman? Is he necessarily going to win in a straight fight? You don't necessarily know. So the two kind of merge into each other when you're talking in terms of the comics and movie worlds. I mean, you have all the superheroes like the Marvel movies, but now you're bringing in people like Shang-Chi, who's not a superhero in that sense. And yet, you know, they'll be referring to him as a superhero. Conan was often called a superhero, and he's not. You know, mm-hmm. Conan was a guy with, he had really great strength, but it was strength that always at a level that, you know, a real human being could kind of have. If, you know, he couldn't go farther beyond a thing, or else it was just kind of got ridiculous. And Robert E. Howard never let him go beyond that. And, you know, Tarzan was kind of close, because Tarzan seemed like a superhero in a way. Killing these animals, could a person really fight a lion and do that? And yet, somehow or other, it almost worked because he seemed like a normal person. So there are all the gradations from Superman down to Super Snipe, I guess. Super Snipe being an old comic character you don't know anything about.
I do not know Super Snipe. I'm going to look up Super Snipe.
Super Snipe was a comic for in the 40s for a while. He was a kid he was the kid with the most comic books in America. That was his, and he would daydream, and in his daydreams, he was this red and blue clad superhero called Super Snipe. And, you know, he's beating up Hitler and he's catching criminals, and it's all a kind of a daydream, you know, and so forth. But, look up Super Snipe sometime.
Oh, I will.
They were entertaining stories. They ran for a number of years in the 40s from the Street and Smith Company.
And just to throw this in there, Super Snipe was the very first time ever written on a comic book was the word superhero.
Was it?
The kid's actually reading reading a comic book.
Yeah,
it
but
says superhero on it.
But the word superhero, I think Simon and Kirby used it in the Guardians origin back in the 40s. The cover.
On the cover. That was the first time. So it's funny you're saying that for superhero. Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that. Was it really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't know.
Yeah, because I remember Bill Everett and other people telling me we never called them superheroes. They were just heroes. That was Submariner was the hero I made up. They didn't use the term superhero until the 60s or so.
Simon
really.
And Kirby was the first to use it.
Simon Kirby in the Guardians origin in Star Spangled Kid number 6 or 7, I think it was, whichever one it was, where they were introduced. Yeah.
Well, it was a word that needed to come into existence, I guess. So.
Anyway, it's a long-winded answer to a simple question you didn't even ask.
No, it's great. It was a philosophical question.
You didn't
Those
know you
were all long-winded
Super
answers.
Snipe today, did you? You didn't know you were about Super Snipe.
I'm looking up maybe Super Snipe's in the public domain now. Maybe I'll start writing
He
Super
is.
Snipe.
Well, I don't know. Street and Smith is one of the very few publishers besides, you know, DC, Marvel, they kept up their copyrights. So when I did it, I have an issue of Alter Ego coming out soon about Street and Smith and so forth. And it was harder to find the artwork. You had to have people that have the comics, because none of the public domain sites online that will have a whole mess, hundreds and thousands of old comics, mm-hmm. but they don't have Street and Smith because they don't, you know, because they're not public domain. So mm-hmm. Super Snipe isn't even public domain. You know, I could reproduce a cover by fair use, but I couldn't reproduce a whole story like I could have, the Black Terror or some other character that's in public domain.
All right, John, we got to.
Anyway,
that's it.
Well, this has been a great pleasure, great privilege. And I look forward. John says you're working on autobiography, and I can't wait to.
File with nothing in it yet, you know. You know, I'm one of these people, instead of writing it, I spend time talking about it and, you know, and so forth. And you know, there's always some other project. I want to do it because it would be fun to do. I don't know anybody to say buy it. Certainly nobody's going to pay me that much to write it. And that's not the point. But, you know, there's always an alter ego issue to put together that takes a lot more work than I could ever earn from it. You know, the three Edgar Rice Burroughs strips I do for the Edgar Rice Burroughs site online, an occasional assignment from Marvel or somebody a couple of books I'm, you know, working on, you know, where I select the best stories, you know, and so forth for the Folio Society or somebody. There's always some little weird project like that and keeps pushing it further back in the future and so forth. But I'm hoping this is the year I'll finally get started on it. Oh. And that this is the decade in which I'll finish it.
And John, just so you know, you can use the blog. I sent you some pictures and stuff, but you can use the blog and you can take any of those pictures too. That's the one that has the Roy Thomas Spider-Man costume. You might want a few of that on my Hero Envy blog. So if you want to take that, you can use any one of those pictures too, because that has a lot of the stuff too you're talking about. But I sent you a few pictures as well.
That's perfect. Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, so I appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely.
A couple that caught my
eye. Well, it was fun. Thank you very much.
All right, gentlemen, you have a wonderful rest of the weekend.
Thank you, John. Thank you very, very much.
Okay, thank you.